All right. My name is Nick Mantinelli. I'm a seismologist, postdoc at Brown currently. I'm super excited to be here at this year's CIDR. It's my first CIDR workshop, and I'm really excited about this year's theme. So I thought I would present to you mainly work that I did during my PhD with Peter Scheer at UC San Diego. And most of that work entailed looking at high-frequency seismic waveforms, and we had a beautiful introduction to body wave seismology yesterday. Our primary signals are these body waves, P, and the underside multiples, PP. But there's also a lot of other energy in these waveforms. And what I did during my PhD is I tried to characterize this energy and discern what it meant about small-scale structure in the deep Earth. But before I go into that, there's a shameless plug for some of my newer research that I have a poster on. Basically, this is a figure that shows that predictions, if you take a geotherm inferred from xenolith thermobarometry, and you forward calculate what the phase velocity should be given a depleted composition, you usually get something that disagrees with the observations. So come see my poster this Friday and we can talk about why that is. So, observations in Earth structure. So, seismologists deal with waveforms. Probably the simplest thing we can do is measure travel times, anomalies, travel time anomalies. And if we do this at enough stations, we can start to tease out what the velocity structure is of the Earth. And seismologists have been doing this for over a century. We have a really good understanding of what the average one-dimensional velocity structure of the Earth. We have a whole suite of 1D models, and these are powerful because they can predict the travel times of the main seismic phases, the P wave, the S wave, the underside multiples, surface wave dispersion, the core waves, PKP. We can predict those travel times within a few seconds using these 1D models. Now, in recent decades, the shift has been to understand three-dimensional heterogeneity, so you can invert for lateral variations in seismic velocity by taking your lateral variations in seismological observations. So here are five examples of groups that have done this, and I've taken away the names of the models because I don't want to argue about which model is best. I'm just trying to illustrate the point that all of these models agree about the large-scale structure of the Earth, but as you move from left to right, you progressively get more and more small-scale structure, and the root mean square perturbations in these models increases. And so this is work by Matthias Machete and Barbara Romanowicz. One thing that you can quantitatively do to measure the resolution of seismic tomography is to take two models and then compare how they're agreeing. You compute the correlation coefficient as a function of spherical harmonic degree, which is basically a proxy for the inverse scale length, and as a function of depth. So if you take models A and B and do that, you will see that in the uppermost mantle near the surface of the Earth, you're agreeing out to spherical harmonic degree 16. There's poorer agreement in the mid-mantle, but as you approach the core mantle boundary, agreement improves again, well correlated out to spherical harmonic degree 8. And if you don't think in terms of spherical harmonics, that corresponds roughly to scales of about 1 to 2,000 kilometers, depending on the depth. But we're interested at this workshop in reconciling geophysical and geochemical heterogeneity, and that compositional heterogeneity is generally thought to be at much smaller scales. So this is a cartoon by Stixrud and others showing a mechanical mixture of basalt and Hartzbergite throughout the mantle, and if the basalt transforms eclogite, becomes more dense, it might accumulate the base of the mantle, forming a large low shear velocity province. But the question I'm interested in is, what can seismology tell us about the scale length and the strength of this smaller stuff in the mid-mantle and in the lower mantle and the upper mantle? Can we get observational constraints on that from seismology? So I'll talk a little bit about how we do that. And first, I need to distinguish between deterministic and scattered arrivals. This is a real waveform. It's filtered at relatively long periods, actually, 20 to 40 seconds. And it's recorded in Pinyon Flat Observatory near San Diego. The deterministic phases are the P wave here and the underside multiple PP. And they're called deterministic because they can be well explained to first order by these one-dimensional Earth models that we have. But the energy in between that is not predicted by those Earth models. And it can actually be well modeled as a superposition of scattered waves that are bouncing off small scale, randomly distributed heterogeneity throughout the deeper Earth. Now, the real power of looking at these scattered waves is that they're excited by heterogeneities that are on order of the seismic wavelength, which is just the wave speed times the period. And to some extent, we can control the period of our observation by applying a filter to the broadband data that we're recorded at, or that is being recorded at our station. So for example, if we pick a filter that's peaked at 1 hertz or 1 second, P waves travel through the mantle at about 10 kilometers per second. Our wiggles are going to be telling us about heterogeneities that are 10 kilometers in scale. And we can play with the period of this filter to try to tease out contributions from larger scale heterogeneity and to some extent even smaller scale heterogeneity. So as a seismologist, I'm a little bit strange because I don't really care about where the blobs are in space as a function of radius, latitude, and longitude. I care more about the statistical properties of the heterogeneity. That is, what is the root mean square strength of the heterogeneity, and what is the correlation length of the heterogeneity. So this is an autocorrelation function that I use to describe the heterogeneity, and it has two free parameters, the root mean square strength, and the correlation length, and here's a random realization of that field. The Fourier transform of this function is the heterogeneity spectrum, and this is basically the function that goes into all these forward models that we use to describe our observations. Now, part of this talk involves trying to pitch or sell the code that we use to run these forward models in hopes that you guys might try to use it yourself. And in order for me to make that sell, I need to explain to you the deficiency of the old way of doing things. So kind of the old and more simplistic way of doing things was taking a single scattering approach. And the advantage of this method is that it's fast to compute, you get an exact solution after one iteration, and it's relatively intuitive. So basically what you do is you take your mantle or wherever you want to model heterogeneity and you divide that up into little volume cells. And then for each one of those volume cells, you calculate the travel time from your source to the scatterer, then from the scatterer to the receiver, and then to figure out the scattered amplitude at that time, you have to integrate over all model cells, and you calculate the scattered power, which is this function of scattering angle, the function of the root mean square perturbation, and the scale length, and some of these other properties. One thing I like to point out is that it's a really strong function of frequency. So scattering is most dominant at the higher frequency. So this is wave number here, which is proportional to frequency. Now, this might sound simple to do, but there's a lot of limitations. For one thing, there's no energy conservation. So it's treating the wave field as a sum of the direct wave and the scattered wave. So basically, you're getting energy from nothing there. It can't account for multiple scattering, and it's cumbersome to keep track of all of these other important factors that affect seismic amplitude. So for example, geometrical spreading when you have multiple phase branches. Yesterday we learned about triplications due to the 410 and 660. In order to do this correctly, you need to keep track of scattering in between all of those different branches and know what their geometrical spreading factor is. And you also need to keep track of how reflection and transmission coefficients change as rays, scattered rays versus direct rays strike interfaces at different angles. So it quickly becomes a very cumbersome task in terms of all the bookkeeping. Also, it's really hard to account for the scattering attenuation and the modal conversions between P and S using this approach. So, given all these limitations, I suggest that going forward, we all use this phonon approach. And basically, it involves modeling scattering as a random walk of discrete energy particles that travel along these ray theoretical trajectories, and they experience random scattering events that are derived from the heterogeneity properties that we put in to the forward model. And after you sum over millions or even billions of these phonons, you obtain a smooth envelope function that you can then compare with your observations. So it's really a forward modeling problem. Here is an example that is meant to illustrate how the phonon code actually works. So if you have a P wave striking a discontinuity here where you have positive impedance, you can calculate the reflection and transmission coefficients here. So these are the energy normalized versions, where basically I force the square of all them to sum to 1. And basically the phonon code works is if you take a set of 100 phonons and they strike that interface, on average, 15 of them will be backscattered as a P wave. 70 of them will be scattered forward or refracted as a P wave. 5 of them will be backscattered as an S wave. And 10 of them will convert to an S wave and be scattered forward. So that's how it keeps track of amplitudes crossing interfaces. When the ray traverses through a block of heterogeneity, some of those phonons scatter to P waves, so it's basically bent in the forward direction. Some of those scatter to S waves. This also accounts for backscattering, which is an important consideration for scattering attenuation, and this has more of a sensitivity to density perturbations. Velocity perturbations tend to just bend the rays in the forward direction. Density tends to scatter energy backwards. And finally, it also accounts for multiple scattering. You can have multiple, there's no limit to how many scattering events can happen in the volume. And then finally, in the case where the heterogeneity is relatively weak, most of the phonons aren't scattered at all. And this actually is your direct ray. And you'll notice that there are fewer phonons in the direct ray after passing the heterogeneous medium than the original. And this is how it naturally accounts for scattering attenuation. So that's a quick overview, and I put the code up on GitHub. It's under my username, nmancinelli/psphoton. My PhD advisor, Peter Scheer, is the brains behind this code. He wrote the first version in 2004. There's a nice GJI paper from that year that explains the mechanics of the code. He currently has a graduate student named Wei, who is adapting the code for problems in crustal scattering as applied to Southern California. So I encourage you to think about using this code in your research if you're trying to model these scatter phases to see what sorts of heterogeneity, length scales, and strengths are consistent with your models. So with the final few minutes I have, I'm just going to go really quickly through the greatest hits of what I've worked on with the phonon code. This is a travel time curve that shows a variety of scattered phases. And I'm just going to focus on 3 of them today, namely P-coda, which is sensitive to heterogeneity in the mantle, PKP precursors, it's a really powerful phase that has unique sensitivity to heterogeneity in the lower mantle, and PKKP, the precursors that are sensitive to topography, small-scale topography on the core mantle boundary. And here are ray diagrams of these 3 phases. So PKKP has 2 core legs and underside bounce off the core mantle boundary, sensitive again to that topography. PKP is really going to give us constraints on lower mantle heterogeneity. And P-coda, it turns out, is mostly sensitive to heterogeneity in the surface because it's just so much stronger than heterogeneity in the lower mantle. So to model scattering from core mantle boundary topography using this approach, we basically need to know the probability of energy scattering away from that specular direction as it's incident on the underside of that boundary. And this can be related directly to the spectrum of topography, the scale length and strength of topography on that core mantle boundary. Now here's an example of a result. Basically, we download all the data we can, and we window around PKP, we filter the data around 1 hertz, and we compute envelope functions. We align on some reference phase. In this case, it's PKKPBC. And so this peak over here on the right side of the figure is actually the reference phase. This discontinuity in the plot is artificial, basically because the scattered phases for the deep Earth tend to be so weak that we have to artificially enhance the signal so that you can see it. So it's distinctly non-zero, it's a robust signal, but it's 10 times weaker, or even more, maybe 5% of the signal of the direct phase. So we have to scale it up in that sense. These are the underside bounce points from the PKKP. This is our source receiver distribution, so a lot of data go into these stacks. In the first order, we can model this signal by putting small-scale topography on the core mantle boundary. It has a root mean square height of 390 meters over lateral correlation distances of 7 kilometers. Now I'm going to go through lower mantle heterogeneity constraints from PKP. And again, this is a really important phase to those of us who study small-scale heterogeneity in the deep Earth, because it has this unique sensitivity to lowermost mantle heterogeneity. And our preferred model has 0.1% perturbations at length scales of 6 kilometers, although this length scale can vary a bit depending on how you filter your waveforms. One of the really important results from this work and similar works is that whole mantle scattering tends to fit the time dependence of these data better than models where you restrict heterogeneity to just the D double prime region. So when that was first discovered, I think in the 1990s, 1997 or 1998, this was interpreted to be evidence for heterogeneity, boatloads of heterogeneity filling the entire mantle. And I think that observation still holds to this day, although this constraint, 0.1%, is pretty stringent. So I think that could actually potentially play a role in constraining strain rates in the mantle, comparing or trying to constrain how quickly heterogeneity is created and destroyed in the mantle. And then finally, I'm going to talk about PCODA. So I spent quite a bit of time during my PhD trying to understand how to model the frequency dependence, or these are periods, inverse frequency up top, and the range and time dependence of the PCODA wave field. And so I was able to model that basically by filling the upper mantle with fractally distributed heterogeneity, but that heterogeneity had to be really strong, root mean square perturbations of 10%. And to some extent, you can understand that by the fact that the spectrum of heterogeneity is so wide in this case, or the bandwidth of heterogeneity is so wide that the root mean square perturbations increase and increase as you widen that bandwidth. But one of the blind spots of looking at PCODA is there's this really strong trade-off between how thick you make that heterogeneous layer near the surface and how strong the heterogeneity is. So this cartoon is meant to illustrate that you can have a relatively thick heterosphere with weak heterogeneity, or a thin heterosphere with strong heterogeneity, and you'll get identical CODA amplitude observations that are indistinguishable by the data. So during my postdoc, I tried to resolve this by looking at how CODAs vary by earthquake depth. And just conceptually, if you have an earthquake that occurs right at the surface, you're going to have scattering both near the earthquake and near the receiver. And so you're going to get a pretty strong CODA there right after the direct P wave. If you have an earthquake that's a bit deeper, say it's at the base of that heterosphere, most of the scattering is going to occur near the receiver. So your early CODA is going to be much weaker. But then you have this issue of a depth phase coming in later. So for this analysis, it's important to consider the early CODA that's in between the direct P and the depth phase PP. So little p, big P has a strong CODA because that leg goes up, and then it comes through. It actually passes through this heterosphere three times. But if you move the earthquake even deeper than that, the early CODA amplitude doesn't change very much anymore. The depth phase is pushed back a little bit because the event's deeper. But keep this logic in mind as I show you the data on the next slide. So I went about and measured 200,000 petelecisms, plotted them all in one graph. There are tons of scatter, but if you were to plot the median or mean in each earthquake depth bin, which is here on the x-axis, see that earthquake CODA is really strong for shallow events. It's much weaker, about a factor of three times weaker for these deeper events. Now this wiggle here is basically an artifact of the depth phase passing through the measurement window. So I have to think about a better way to get rid of that signal. But what is definitely robust is that there's this constancy. So there's very weak heterogeneity between 200 and 660 kilometers here, because these amplitudes aren't decreasing at all in that depth window. Now, in some sense, this is a really nice result because it agrees quite well with a study published this year by Dan Frost, who I think is around here, and Sebastian Ross and Ed Garnero, where they used a completely different approach to try to understand the depth extent of heterogeneity in the mantle. So what they did is they looked at this phase called P prime, which is basically a PKP ray that backscatters off a heterogeneity in the far side of the mantle, and then it comes all the way back. And what they did using sophisticated array approaches is they measured exact locations for a whole bunch of scatterers, and this darker black line is actually a histogram of those locations. And most of the scatterers are actually in the uppermost 200 kilometers. There's a subtle depth dependence here. It looks like there's an increase at the base of the mantle transition zone. But the lower mid-mantle tends to be relatively weak, and then it gradually ramps up again near the core mantle boundary. And the cool thing is that this roughly corresponds with the root mean square perturbations that are retrieved in global seismic tomography studies. So we think that these scatterers are, the strength of these scatterers and the frequency of these scatterers are correlated with the strengths of the perturbations that are recovered by, at the largest scales, by global seismic tomography.
Nick, can I ask a question? About this depth dependence. So what is the sensitivity of these scattered waves to the anomalies in the mantle? So isn't there the problem that the body wave tomography models usually are very sensitive to anomalies at the boundaries of the domain? And this decrease in the mid-mantle might also be just a reduced sensitivity to anomalies. Is that the same for scattered waves, or is that different?
So I believe you're referring to the problem in global seismic tomography where, I mean, as I showed at the beginning of this talk, there's not good correlation out to even spherical harmonic degree. And I mean, the global seismic tomographers can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's mainly due to surface waves having resolution in the upper mantle and body waves primarily turned in the lowermost mantle. And so that's why resolution tends to be best in those two regions. For scattered waves, we shouldn't have that limitation, particularly using Dan Frost's method.
So in a way, your method confirms that there actually is not much.
I would say so, yes.
I guess for the sake of the students, I just want to correct a common misconception about the depth, which regions of the mantle are well illuminated. For body waves, it's true, we're not talking about the scattering that Nick's talking about, but actually kind of the deterministic part that he started his talk with. If you take travel time measurements and you invert for a tomographic model, those travel time measurements are most sensitive to structure in the region where the ray is turning. That means that for kind of large scales like global studies, you are actually sensitive throughout most of the mantle. It's not just at the bottom of the mantle. There's plenty of waves that turn in the mid-mantle. The only problem is that in the upper mantle, you don't have that many waves turning because the distribution of sources and receivers is such that you're often at kind of large enough epicentral distances that you don't have good coverage that's globally uniform in the upper mantle. So that's why, for example, in the upper mantle, we don't have good VP global models because surface waves are sensitive to VS, so they cover you in the VS side, but on the VP side, there's nothing to cover you.
Just a small point, but I think you said that beyond 200 kilometers depth, it went down to a third of the power. I would have just expected it to be a half if it's passing through it once instead of twice.
Yeah, that's a good question. And it turns out you can model this behavior really well with the phonon code. And I think that's mainly due to you can measure this drop as a third rather than one half with the phonon code. And I think that's mainly due to scattering going as you're moving through that heterosphere. It's not single scattering, so it's not necessarily linear like you say. Because there's so much heterogeneity that has to be in the uppermost 200 kilometers. So.
So like you're talking a lot about their heterogeneity. So what kind of heterogeneity? Is that composition or crystal preferred orientation or things like that?
So, I mean, that's a good question. We parameterize it in perhaps the simplest way we can to describe our data, which is just as percent fluctuations in VP, and those are proportional to percent fluctuations in VS, or actually they're equal to each other in the way we parameterize it. And then we say that density fluctuations are like 0.2 times those, and that's just the conventional way of doing it in the field. It's not necessarily the best way, but it's a good point in that we know that the upper mantle is anisotropic, so presumably anisotropy that is not spatially coherent could also scatter energy. And that's something that, to my knowledge, has not been explored very much at all.
Yeah, I've been looking at this plot now for a while, but it looks like for the shallow earthquakes, the scatter is much broader than for the deeper ones. Is there some geographical pattern to that, or is that a bias of some?
So I have started to map out the lateral variations. I didn't put them in this talk. A lot of this, so as you know, there's tons of stuff that goes into amplitude. So part of it is the focal mechanism. Sometimes you'll be on a node and that'll spike, but that's actually the cause for a lot of the variation at all depths. Sometimes your direct phase will originate from near a node, and then your scattered energy will have to be stronger because it's all relative. That's how these measurements are all made. Near the surface, yeah, it looks like the scatter is much, much larger than that. And it's actually a good question why that variance appears to be larger, and I haven't looked into that specifically. Something that can happen, and we don't know how big of a deal it is in global averages, is that you can have topography near a subduction zone, and water multiples can ring around in there for a long time, and energy can leak out. So that could actually be a reason why the root mean square heterogeneity has to be 10%, which seems quite large. There are certain paths where you only need to make it as large as, say, 6%. And those tend to be far away from subduction zones. But just to finish up, this is my last real slide. Trying to put it all together in terms of what does this mean for the heterogeneity spectrum, I've divided the Earth, the mantle, into two regions, the heterosphere, the uppermost 200 kilometers, and I've lumped all the mantle below that together. Which is a gross oversimplification, but it's kind of what I have to work with here. If you take the spectrum of heterogeneity that we use to model PCOTA and extrapolate that, that actually overpredicts what you would get if you extrapolated global seismic tomography. This is really a surface wave dispersion. So maybe this is related to this issue of near surface nonlinearities. In the deeper mantle, however, if you were to extrapolate the tomography data, you could imagine a nice intersection with what they see at long periods and what we see at short scales, and you could imagine this nice transition between a spectrum that falls off steeply for thermal heterogeneity as it transitions to a more gradually sloping compositional dominated heterogeneity spectrum. So that's a little bit more speculative, but just trying to put it all together in one coherent picture. Here's a summary of the constraints, and I'm definitely out of time, so thank you for your attention.